have found the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. All right, Mr. Prime Minister, you are out there someplace.
Yes, I am, in Israel, not someplace, in a very definite place. Good to talk to you, Larry.
Thank you, sir. You know, you may not remember this. I mean, I want to talk about your great book. It's called Bibby. It's just my story, Bibby, out and about. But you may not remember this. Jack Kemp introduced us when you were, I guess, either running for finance minister or you were finance minister. And then a second time, Ronald Lauder had us to dinner at the old Mark Hotel. And we talked about supply side economics. And it turns out you governed as finance minister and then multiple times as prime minister as a free market guy. And you liberated the Israeli economy. So I want to say congratulations, and I'm very proud of you, sir.
Well, you're very kind, and you had some influence. Jack Kemp, too, I remember that he said to me, I have only three things to tell you. Lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes. He was right. And we did that, and it works.
It did work. So the Israeli economy has become one of the best in the world.
Yes, it has. We've look, I inherited, I described this in my book, among other things. I had a clear vision that to survive, the Jewish state has to be strong. To be strong, it needs a strong army. To keep a strong army, it needs a strong economy. To get a strong economy, you have to turn it from a semi-socialist state to a free market capitalist state. To do that required dozens and dozens of reforms that basically liberated the genius and enterprise of our people. So having done that, and it's politically very difficult to do, as you can imagine, it was, Israel's GDP per capita that trailed all the Western European countries, and certainly America by far, has now surpassed Japan's, France, Britain, and recently Germany, too. So we're on the right path, and God willing, in a few days, I'll be forming another government, and we'll continue on that same path.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Prime Minister, what else, what new reforms? And can I just ask you also, Israel is right nearby some major deposits, if I'm not mistaken, of oil and natural gas, which would make it a terrific powerhouse and would add to the economic story. Can you talk about that?
Well, actually, I describe in the book, one of the battles that I had to fight was to get the offshore deposits of natural gas under the seabed in the eastern Mediterranean, in our territorial and economic waters. I had to get them out of the sea, and I couldn't because I had this, you know, this ultra-radical progressive wing that said you have to keep it in the sea for environmental reasons. I mean, environmental reasons, this is the best way to replace coal if you have natural gas and so on. We had to fight that. I did. I won. And now we're exporting gas to the Palestinians in Jordan nearby. But in addition, what I intend to do is lay a pipeline to LNG plant in nearby, probably in Cyprus, and export massively to Europe, which I think would very much welcome that event. So we've turned Israel not only into economic independence, but into energy independence, and it's a big thing, obviously.
Well, and it would presumably enormously strengthen your hand in all manner of peace or war or politics in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think that we have that coming anyway because with President Trump and his team, I changed the equation. Everybody said you can't make peace with the Arab countries unless you first solve the problem with the Palestinians. The problem with that is the Palestinians don't want to solve a problem with Israel. They want a peace without Israel. They don't want a state next to Israel. They want a state instead of Israel. And so if you wait for them, you'll wait for another quarter of a century, another half a century, until we can get another peace treaty in addition to the ones we had with Egypt and Jordan 25 years ago and before that. I said, let's go directly to the Arab world. And we did. And we got four peace treaties with the United Arab Emirates, with Bahrain, with Morocco, and with Sudan. And if you ask me what are my plans, well, I think we should expand it. And the most important country that we could expand it to, it would be a quantum leap, would be Saudi Arabia. And I think that would effectively end the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is about 98% of the Arab world, and it'll leave the Palestinians, who are still recalcitrant, and I hope we'll get them in a genuine and realistic peace too. But this is something that's definitely on my dashboard, and whether we can achieve it, of course, depends on the Saudi leadership and others, but I think there's a real chance.
Prime Minister, how important was your working relationship with Donald Trump on the Abraham Accords and other matters?
I think it was vital. I mean, President Trump was a great president, a great friend of Israel, I have to say, a great champion of breaking the rules. Somebody asked me how would I call him, and I called him irreverent. He was irreverent in the sense that he was out of the box. He wasn't committed to the, stayed tried and failed narratives of the past. So he was open to other things, and that was very important. He recognized Jerusalem as our capital, which is kind of late in the game, but no president did that before him. 3,000 years ago, King David proclaimed Jerusalem as our capital, so it's about time, you'd think. He moved the American embassy there. He recognized our sovereignty in the Golan Heights. He withdrew from the disastrous Iran nuclear deal that paved Iran's path with gold to a nuclear arsenal and gave it hundreds of billions of dollars. All these things were fine. Doesn't mean we didn't have disagreements, but I am appreciative of the fact that he did these things, and I'm glad to state and restate that.
Prime Minister, can I beg your indulgence? I need to take a quick commercial break, and then I'd like to come back and talk some more about your new book entitled Bibi, My Story. Are you okay with that, sir?
Absolutely.
All right. I appreciate your waiting. The name of the book is Bibi. We're talking, of course, to the great Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back with much more on Mr. Netanyahu.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Larry Kudlow. We are talking to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has graciously agreed to stay a while longer. The name of the book is called Bibi, My Story. It's hot off the presses. Prime Minister, you are, of course, famous for proclaiming the need for peace through strength. I might add, I myself worked for Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, both of whom agreed with that view, peace through strength. The biggest threat in your area is Iran. Can you talk to us? What are you saying in the book about Iran? How will you approach Iran now in your next term as Prime Minister?
Well, I'll do everything in my power to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapons, but that's not only because they threaten to annihilate my country, Israel. It's because they chant death to Israel, death to America. They call us the small Satan. They call you the big Satan. Mm. And in fact, all nuclear proliferation is bad, but it makes a hell of a difference if Holland has nuclear weapons or the Ayatollahs have nuclear weapons. The Ayatollahs are a theological thuggery. They oppress their own people, and the whole world now has seen Iran's true character unmasked thanks to the incredible courage and bravery of these Iranian women and men who are dying in the streets for their freedom. And this regime that subjugates their own people threatens to annihilate my country and threaten and blackmail you because if they were given the wherewithal to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles, which they're working on, and to have them tipped with nuclear warheads, which they're working on, that would change history. It would be a pivot of history, a pivot of catastrophe. And therefore, my battle is obviously for my country, the one and only Jewish state, and we won't let these Ayatollahs erase 4 millennia of Jewish history. But it's also for the future of our common civilization. You cannot have Iran, the worst enemy of our civilization, have nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them to every American city. I've devoted a good part of my life, and by the way, a very big part of my book, to this ongoing battle, some of which I describe. I can't describe all the things that we've done. I describe how I sent one operation, the Mossad, into the heart of Tehran. They found a dilapidated warehouse where Iran was hiding its secret atomic archive. They broke into the safes. They knew which safes contained the material. Spilfered away half a ton of material. If you saw Argo, this was Argo on steroids, yeah, because thousands of Iranian security personnel were chasing them throughout Tehran. But they got out. They brought the material to Israel. I brought it to President Trump in the Oval Office, and I was delighted when the president left that deal. But it's an ongoing battle. It's an ongoing battle to prevent Iran from having the wherewithal to threaten all of us.
And, of course, they are the prime sponsors of terrorism and murder throughout the Middle East and probably everywhere in the world.
Yes, and they now send killer drones to Ukraine. So you know something. Nothing good will come out of the fact that they'll be able to get a nuclear arsenal, which they will if this deal goes through, and they'll get it with basically an international seal of approval of a P5 plus one, what they call the major powers of the world, giving their blessing to this course, which basically kicks the can only a few years, but gives Iran sanctions relief that is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. That's folly, the height of folly. I'm opposed to it. If you want to know, and I talk about it, what will stop a rogue regime from having nuclear weapons, the answer is the only thing that stops it is not an agreement which they cheat on anyway, and won't stop them even if they don't cheat. What stops them is the combination of crippling economic sanctions, and most importantly, and irreplaceably, a credible military option. That's what stopped Iraq from doing it. Saddam Hussein, we stopped him. That's what stopped Syria from developing a nuclear weapon. We stopped him. That's what stopped Gaddafi, an American threat, and he volunteered, didn't even have to be attacked. But it didn't stop North Korea because nobody actually had that over their heads. So they are, now half of Asia is quaking with fear. They can threaten Japan, and they may very well threaten the west coast of the United States very soon. North Korea is an anthill compared to Iran. It is a neighborhood bully, but it is not a global ideological force that is absolutely opposed to our way of life, our freedoms, our values. Do not let Iran have nuclear weapons.
I don't understand, Prime Minister, why the Biden administration is making the same mistake the Obama administration isn't trying to make a deal. I don't understand it. I just don't get it. It makes no, for all the reasons you've said, for all the reasons when I worked for Trump. I tell you what, sir, before we answer that, let me take a hard break, okay? And then you'll come back and talk some more about that. And also, I want to talk about your own brave service in the Israeli Special Forces. If you could just stay a little bit more with us. Folks, we're talking to Prime Minister Netanyahu. The name of the book is Bibi, My Story. It's a riveting book, and you can hear the Prime Minister's points of view. We'll be right back. I'm Kudlow.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We are still here with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has graciously agreed to give us even more of his valuable time. He has his new book out. It is called Bibi, My Story. He's a world-renowned figure. Everybody knows who he is. It's a terrific book, a good long read. Prime Minister, thank you for this. I want to go back to this point. The Biden administration is making the same mistake, it seems to me, that the Obama administration made. They want to make some kind of nuclear deal with Iran. As you yourself said, the Iranians, of course, always lie and cheat. They never tell the truth. This would entail, a deal would entail lifting economic sanctions, providing hundreds of billions of dollars to Iran, for which they will use to do nothing more than making great mischief in the region and around the world. Now, I know this is a delicate matter. I'm not trying to upset the diplomatic apple cart. You're going to be prime minister again, and Mr. Biden is the president. But I don't understand any of that logic. Why would anyone want to do that?
Well, this was a point of disagreement, sharp disagreement between President Obama and myself. I respected the president, but I disagreed with him. And I describe in my book how I made a very tough decision to take on an invitation to address the joint session of Congress and to challenge the in 2015 the Iran nuclear deal. By the way, the worst time I had was the evening before. My sinuses were clogged. I couldn't finish any mid-sentence, practicing the speech. So I got up in the morning having not slept a wink, made my way to the Capitol, and lo and behold, right when I saw the Capitol steps, my sinuses cleared for a few hours, like divine revelation. The waters had parted. I gave a speech.
I have the same back. Sinus problem, by the way, sir. So I get it. But it was an act of God. God wanted you to be in shape for this.
You have to have divine intervention. At least there was in this case. So, we disagreed then. And, my sense is that although there seems to be, or there seemed until recently to be, continuity in this policy with the President Biden's administration, I sense that there's a change, probably because of the unfolding events in Iran that are so extraordinary and so, frankly, inspiring. The battle for basic human freedom that the brave citizens of Iran are putting forth, that I think that's been put on hold, I hope permanently. I intend to bring it up with President Biden, who's been a personal friend of mine for the last 40 years. Again, not because we've not had disagreements. We have, but we respect and like each other. So I intend to bring it up with him in the first available opportunity.
I mean, one of the things I find troubling is that the senior people in the Biden administration at the NSC and the State Department and so forth, and the president himself, never talk about the Abraham Accords, never talk favorably. They have a euphemism for it. And the Abraham Accords were a great achievement between you and President Trump and the other members, the Arab Gulf states who joined in. But it always seemed to me like the Bidens are giving a cold shoulder to the Abraham Accords and keep playing footsie with Iran. And to me, that defies any common sense, and it certainly defies any strategic sense. I mean, will they help you in your judgment, or will you ask them to help you to broaden the Abraham Accords, for example, to bring the Saudis in? Because I frankly think the Bidens have bungled relations with Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis are key.
Well, I have two immediate goals. One is to block Iran's quest for nuclear weapons, continue to block it, because I think the actions that Israel has taken over the years that my governments have taken, set back Iran for at least a decade, but they're still pursuing it. So the jury's still out on all of us. So one thing is to block Iran's quest for nuclear weapons. That's a global interest, not merely an Israeli interest. It's certainly an American interest. And the second one is to further expand the circle of peace and effectively end the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I hope I can find in President Biden, any American president, a partner for these two extraordinary causes. I think they're both doable.
In terms of expanding this Abraham Accords, isn't open trade and investment a key part of this, cooperative economic development among the countries involved? Wouldn't that be a key part of this?
Well, it is. It is. This is what is happening. Before that, we had what I'd call a cold peace between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan. That is, we're non-belligerents and we go and see each other and so on. But our economies didn't mesh. But my vision of the peace with the Gulf states and under the Abraham Accords was that we actually have a peace between our peoples, our business people, our entrepreneurs, the tourism. It's extraordinary. What has happened is almost defies imagination. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis are flying over the skies of Saudi Arabia today. So you understand that the Soviets certainly do not look askance at these agreements, and that gives hope for the future, for the immediate future. But look also what is happening. There are billions and billions of dollars of joint ventures, of common business enterprises that are happening, which is that's really creating the fabric of a genuine peace that we all want to see. And if you ask me, Can this be expanded with Saudi Arabia? It won't be just expanded. It'll make a quantum leap if we can get Saudi Arabia. And from there, I believe the rest of the Arab world, then it would change history.
All the meetings that I was involved with in the Oval, but with David Friedman and Jared Kushner and many others, I would always emphasize open trade and investment. And the fact is, you are a free market guy, so I think it's right up your alley. You understand the growth impact. But nothing will heal better than a prosperous region, don't you think, sir? I mean, prosperity is a crucial part of this. Poverty is the enemy of peace. Prosperity is the friend of peace.
Absolutely. Not only do I subscribe to it, I've formulated my policies on that line. So, first of all, within Israel, you know, free up, just must have passed about 80 or 90 market reforms that catapulted Israel into a frontline juggernaut state of innovation. And by the way, you have to understand, that's, as I describe in my book, you know, most people think that the key to economic growth is education and technology. It's not. You can be highly educated, as in the former Soviet Union. They had fantastic metallurgists and mathematicians and physicists, and they produced damn all. But the minute one of these able people was smuggled out to Palo Alto, he was beginning to generate wealth within days. Free markets, I would say differently. I would say that education and technology do not produce wealth. Free markets do. But if you have the combination, as we do in Israel, of free markets and technology, then that's an unbeatable combination that skyrockets the economy, which is what we've done. So now what I want to do with that, having achieved it in Israel, is to have that same melting, if you will, of interest with our neighbors. And that's definitely happening with the Gulf states, and I believe it can happen with others as well. That really produces the kind of genuine peace, peace from strength, and as you say, peace from prosperity that betters the life of everyone.
We're talking to Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. His new book, Bibi, My Story, hot off the presses. He's very kind and gracious to give us time to talk about this. Prime Minister, I did not know that you went to MIT. All right, that's new information. In fact, I don't really think I knew. You lived here for a good long while, and a lot of your education was in the U.S. That's new information coming out of the book. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I spent my high school years and my university years and high school years outside Philadelphia and my university in Cambridge, Mass. I came in after 5 years of military service in the Israeli Army, so I was sort of older than all these hotshot kids at 18. I decided I have to brush up on my math and physics and discovered that at MIT, in those days at least, all you had to do to finish a semester was take the final test. So I took the test and I passed, and that's how I got rid of 2 years out of the undergraduate and then went to the Sloan School, the business school at MIT. But the real education I got in business was in the Boston Consulting Group with a genius, a real genius, called Bruce Henderson.
Oh.
He called me into his office. Do you know Bruce?
Yes.
Did you ever meet him?
Yeah, I have. Yes, indeed.
Yes. He was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. He was really extraordinary.
Huh.
And that's where I really learned the fundamentals of how economies are made. They're made by firms. Firms create the value, mm-hmm. the added value in the economy, a lot more than government bureaucrats.
Mm.
So you have to create a policy that is hospitable to firms and to competition. But the first day I got into the Boston Consulting Group, BCG, Bruce Henderson calls me to his office, and I was a fresh recruit. I'd never worked in business a day. I was a military officer, for God's sake. I mean, I knew nothing about business or economics. And he said to me, you know, I know you're going to go back to your country and probably be very soon. So learn everything you can here while you're here, because one day it will help your country. And I thought this man was absolute bunkers. Mm. You know, I was 27 years old. What was he talking about? But he was absolutely right. And it served me well. I think it served Israel's economy well.
Yeah, well, you had the rudiments of actually, those are rudiments of free market supply side economics. You have to look at economics should be looked at through the firm. Successful firms create jobs and wages and improve family incomes. It's not governments. It's businesses that do it. You can't have a healthy job with a good-paying wage unless you have a healthy business. Boy, there's a debate about that right now in this country as well. Prime Minister, tell us also, I was not aware, you fought in the special forces of the Israeli Defense Forces, the special forces called the unit. I don't think I knew that. I don't think many people knew that. So you've served your country in many different ways. Tell us about that, or tell us as much about that as you can.
Well, I have joined a special unit. It's kind of it's hard to describe this, but this is a tiny unit of about 100 fighters. We ended up being three brothers in there, my older brother and my younger one, in a unit that's somewhat like a combination of Navy SEALs, SAS, and Delta Force. I don't know, but it's tiny. It's a special unit, and one of the best of its kind in the world. I ended up staying there for 5 years as an officer. I was wounded. I crossed into beyond enemy lines in many clandestine operations, but I had my brushes with death several times. I nearly died in a firefight and nearly drowned in the Suez Canal in the midst of a terrible firefight where I lost a good friend. I was shot. I was wounded in the rescue, the first storming of a hijacked aircraft in history. And we successfully liberated the hostages in Tel Aviv.
When was this? When was this, Prime Minister? When was this, Prime Minister?
This was 1972.
Wow.
And after that, I left this unit. I was released as an officer and went to study at MIT. My older brother remained in the unit, became its commander. And 4 years later, the terrorist, the Palestinian terrorist who had tried to land the airport in Tel Aviv and were killed by us, decided that they could get away with it if they land in the heart of Africa. So they hijacked an Air France plane full of Israelis and Jews, landed it in Entebbe Airport in Uganda, and figured that there's nothing Israel could do. Well, they were wrong. So my brother, my older brother, Jonathan Yoni, landed with his with soldiers from our common unit in the dead of night in Entebbe. He led his force, stormed the old terminal where the hostages were kept, killed the terrorists and the Ugandan troops aiding them, destroyed the MiG fighters who could have given chase to the transport planes that were carrying the hostages and the force back to Israel. But unfortunately, there was only one military casualty in this raid, and that was my brother. So he gave his life at that point to the country, and that obviously changed my life. It was the I would say so agonizing and so difficult that I didn't know that I would actually live or how I would live. But somehow I found the strength through inconsolable grief to pick up where my older brother left off. He never thought that this battle against terrorism was merely a military battle. He saw it as a civilizational battle, a moral battle, and a political battle. I left the Boston Consulting Group and devoted a few years to a public effort to change the way that Western countries thought about battling international terrorism, specifically directing them to fight the states that harbored the terrorists, because without state support, international terrorism collapses. You need a sovereign territory. If you don't have one, you try to make one, the way ISIS tried. You need a state or states. And so I devoted some years, quite successfully, to change Western policies, especially under President Reagan, who you mentioned before. He read a book that I did based on conferences that I had organized. And with the help of George Shultz and others, American policy changed to an active, proactive action against terrorist states. And from there, from public policy, I moved into diplomacy, and from there to politics. So now I'm still in the messy bog of politics, seeking to promote policy. Politics is necessary for policy. Mm-hmm. They're inseparable.
I would just say, personally, it's interesting to hear you refer to Reagan. I worked for Reagan. I was the economics deputy in the Budget Bureau back in those days. I was a child. But Reagan had an enormous impact on my political and economic thinking. And, of course, that was the day. Those were the days when I worked closely with the late Jack Kemp, who was a very dear, dear friend. I mean, actually, in many ways, Prime Minister, so it's over 40 years later when I went to work for Trump, but the Reagan thoughts, the Reagan principles were still always uppermost in my mind. So I understand that. And so you've been driven by this public service ethos. It kind of started from your own experiences as a soldier, it sounds like, in the Israeli Defense Forces, and you've never let up on your views on peace and terrorism and fighting it. I mean, that's what it sounds to me, and I guess that's what the book is trying to say. Is that right? Am I being fair here?
I think you're being fair, and I think it actually starts before that with my father, who was a great historian of the Jewish people. He instilled in me my life's mission, which I also inherited from his father, and obviously my fallen brother. That is that the mission is to assure the permanence and future of the State of Israel by strengthening its strengthening it militarily and economically and diplomatically. But I have lived a life of purpose. And I think that one of the things that people can glean from reading my book are insights into how they can achieve a life of purpose, which I believe is the only life truly worth living.
It's wonderful. Great sentiments. Folks, the name of the book is Bibi, My Story. We have been speaking for the last 45 minutes with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a savior of the State of Israel. Mr. Prime Minister, I can't thank you enough for your time and your patience and your contribution, sir. Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you for your friendship and your wise counsel. I do remember those dinners.
More to be revealed. Take care. Folks, we're going to take a break. I'm Larry Kudlow. We will be right back after these numerous commercial breaks that we've obliterated in order to speak with the Prime Minister.
Larry Kudlow.